It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, a New Republic cover story on Governor Scott Walker and a polarized Wisconsin has gotten a lot of attention and an angry backlash from the governor's supporters. We'll talk to the author of that piece.
First, for all of us here in Wisconsin, we know the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore is a cool place for an outdoor getaway. And after a winter where the park's ice caves drew international attention, the rest of the world is starting to take note, too.
The accolades for the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore keep pouring in. Country Magazine just featured the lakeshore in a recent piece on the best parks in America.
Here to talk more about the park and what visitors can find there this summer is Bob Krumenack. Bob Krumenacker, he's the superintendent of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. Bob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Hi, Rob. Glad to be back.
So Country Magazine refers to the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore as a hidden gem. Would you say that's still a fair assessment? Is it hidden, or is word finally getting out?
Well, I think word's finally getting out, but I was thinking about that. You know, you look at almost any good map of Wisconsin, and the islands at the north tip are always there. So I think in some ways we've been hidden in plain sight, and people have finally figured it out.
Can you put into words the feelings you get when you set foot back in the park after you've been away for a while?
Well, and I'd say in a typical winter, Rob, when we don't have the ice caves, my job keeps me away from the park because I'm not actually out on those islands very often. But it's just one of those mixes of calm and awe-inspiring, and every once in a while Lake Superior reminds us who's the boss. You're isolated out on islands, and there's something about being on an island that I think is just different no matter where you are in the world. It's very special, and you realize that nature is what's most important. What time is the sun rising? Which way is the wind blowing? And maybe most importantly, how big are the waves if I ever want to get home?
And last winter, we saw a huge amount of attention directed at the ice caves. People were coming from around the world, and we talked a little bit about what the scene was like this winter. The ice caves are still there. They're not ice caves anymore. Now they're sea caves. How do people who want to visit in the summer approach them now?
These are probably the best day sea kayaking place to go, certainly in the park and maybe anywhere in North America, I would argue. I think the freshwater sea kayaking here is unparalleled, maybe even in the world. But the caves are only about a mile to 2 miles from the Myers Beach launch site, which is where the center of the world was last winter. It's a little bit calmer this time of year, but we recommend that people who haven't kayaked there before work with an outfitter. Lake Superior is a tough place to learn how to kayak and probably not the smartest place to do it for the first time if you've never done it before. I checked the water temperature readings. The lake is up to 41 degrees right now. So even though air temperatures are getting summer-like, it'll be a long time before there's warm water there.
But so not a lot of swimming yet.
Not a lot of swimming yet. And actually, in a typical year, there's not really that much swimming till end of summer when water temperatures get a little bit more tolerable. But it's a fairly short kayak trip from Myers Beach to the caves, but then the caves extend another 2 miles, and just like in the wintertime when people could walk across the ice and keep going almost as far as they wanted to explore, if you're a kayaker and the conditions are right, you could easily spend half a day to a whole day out there.
Are you seeing a lot of return visitors of people who came up for the first time to see the ice caves?
We are. In fact, during the winter, there were a lot of people who said, I've got to see this place in the summertime. And we've gotten lots of anecdotal reports from the Chamber of Commerce and local B&Bs that bookings are up for the year. And our camping permits are just about equal, maybe a little bit higher than they were last year. June is usually quiet, but I have a feeling July and August are going to be very, very popular up here this year.
I've been coming up to Madeline Island almost every summer, give or take, since I was a girl, and I always just think of the islands as a summer place. When do you think is the best season to see the Apostle Islands?
Well, I thought February was pretty nice this year. That's not the typical answer. Usually the second half of summer is the nicest. The water is warmer. The bugs are, for the most part, gone, or at least more tolerable by midsummer. Actually, if you can go in between the start of school and Labor Day or somewhere in there, you know, it gets a little bit less crowded.
Another big draw up there, and I think this is referenced in that Country Magazine article, the lighthouses. Can you tell us some about them?
Well, one of the things that people don't know is that there are more lighthouses in the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore than any other national park in the country. There's six light stations, as we call them, two of which have two towers each. So there's actually eight standing light towers in the park. And we have rangers stationed all summer at Raspberry Island, which dates from 1863, and it's been lovingly restored. And every once in a while, the ranger dresses up as the lighthouse keeper from the 1920s, so you can get this wonderful historic immersion experience. But we also have volunteers that give tours at Sand Island, and in most years, Michigan Island and Devil's Island lighthouses as well. This year, we've got a big lighthouse maintenance project going on, so Devils and Michigan may not open until the end of summer. But they're more accessible, if you're a boater at least, than most lighthouses around the country, and you can often get a one-on-one experience there.
I was going to ask you about that getting around part of it, because Madeline Island is the one you can take your car over on the ferry. There's roads there, and you can get around. But how do you get to the other islands?
It's a little bit of a tough place. You need some means of getting across water. There is a concession boat called the Apostle Islands Cruises that goes out to Stockton Island, Oak Island, and Raspberry Island on a regular basis. And if you don't have your own boat, there's also water taxis that are available, although I have to say they're a bit pricey. The best way to see the park, of course, is to have a friend with a boat. and that way they pay for the maintenance and the gas. But there's also 12 miles of wonderful mainland coastal strip. We've talked about the caves, which are at one end, and the other end on the east is called Little Sand Bay, and there's a wonderful beach there. There's a historic fishery and another kayak launch site out to some of the other islands. So if you don't have the time or the skills to navigate Lake Superior, or maybe the financial resources, the mainland site is very, very special as well.
What are some great outdoor activities for our lists on a summer visit?
Well, I love hiking on the islands, and particularly going down to what we call the sand spits, which are at the southern end of many of the islands. They tend to be the direction that the current flows, at least when the winds are blowing, and so you get these sandy features at the south end of almost every island, and they tend to be windblown and isolated. They have rare plants, often great birding places. Several of them have really nice campsites. So hiking and camping are the primary things that people do when they're not boating out in the Apostle Islands.
And you can hunt for, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, agate rocks, right?
No, not really. Actually, you're thinking of Isle Royale, probably. We don't have many agates, and actually hunting rocks or even picking flowers is actually prohibited in the National Lakeshore.
Okay, never mind.
Never mind. Good catch, though.
All right, before we let you go, any special events up there that people ought to check out this year?
Well, this is the 10th anniversary of the establishment by the U.S. Congress of the Gaylord Nelson Wilderness, which covers 80% of the land area of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. And while we don't have any particular events planned, it's a great celebration because that 80% of the park is permanently protected as undeveloped for the people of the United States, and most of the camping is actually in the wilderness, and most people in the Midwest think wilderness is some very, very far away place in the West, but they can get it right here at the top of Wisconsin.
Bob, thanks so much for sharing that wilderness with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on again.
That's Bob Krummenacker. He's superintendent of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. A look at the latest cover story in the New Republic of interest here in Wisconsin. The article is titled, "The Unelectable Whiteness of Scott Walker."
In the article, the author gives us a history of Scott Walker's political career. He also goes back in time to get at the root of Milwaukee's racial and political divisions.
Alec McGillis is with us. He's a senior editor at the New Republic and the author of the piece. We did reach out to Scott Walker for this interview. He wasn't available to join us on short notice. Alec, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with the title, "The Unelectable Whiteness of Scott Walker, A Journey Through the Poisonous, Racially Divided World That Produced a Republican Star." Them's fighting words, in a way. Does this article just provoke some of the polarization that you're writing about?
The headline's definitely a little bit edgy, and the New Republic is known for edgy headlines. While I did not write the headline, I do think that the piece backs up the basic thesis, which is that to describe the world that, that Governor Walker comes out of politically, and to make the case that this world has made him possibly not the best candidate for the Republicans in 2016, if they're looking for someone to broaden their party's appeal beyond the relatively narrow one that they're the sort of box that they're in now, that you might want to have someone who's not come up in a kind of in this kind of bubble that that Governor Walker has in these very very with this base of support in the Milwaukee suburbs that is just incredibly monolithic and remarkably homogenous. And that just isn't perhaps not the best sort of landscape in which environment in which to develop as a national candidate.
We'll dig into that landscape a little more, but on the face of it, especially for people looking from around the country, that might seem counterintuitive. They might say, here's a Republican governor who's won, in effect, two statewide elections in a place that went twice for Barack Obama, who was re-elected and re-elected as Milwaukee County executive three times there in an urban environment. He's a guy who can win in places that Republicans won't necessarily win in.
Right. You know, that's exactly the case that is made for him as someone who could sort of reach swing voters and win in a purple kind of place. The piece makes the argument that in the state elections that what you were seeing there was not so much someone winning over swing voters in a purple state, but winning on the basis of this incredibly strong, again, monolithic base of support that comes out at levels of turnout that are just astonishing. I mean, nationally top-ranked levels of turnout. And of course, has run his governor's races and the recall in a midterm off-cycle environment when you don't have the presidential turnout, whereas Wisconsin in presidential years has gone, of course, Democratic for seven straight years. What I wish, trying to explain to readers that really is the secret of his success in Wisconsin, he himself admitted in that terrific recent series in the Journal Sentinel about polarization in Milwaukee, in Metro Milwaukee, that there's really no persuasion going on anymore in Metro Milwaukee, that he himself is just relying on base turnout in the Wild counties. As far as the county, his success as county executive, this is something I wish that I had addressed in the piece. It was cut for space, but the important thing to keep in mind there is, yes, of course, he did win three times as county executive in a blue county. The key factor there to keep in mind is, of course, that the county elections, municipal elections in Milwaukee County are held in the spring, which is, again, a circumstance that tends to produce lower turnout and less of a, frankly, less of an urban turnout. And so that definitely worked to his advantage there. The other thing to keep in mind with his success as Milwaukee County executive is that as soon as he ran for governor in 2010, there was some speculation that he might do pretty well in Milwaukee County because he, of course, had been had lived there and been the executive there. Well, in fact, he did no better than Tom Barrett in 2010 in Milwaukee County compared with previous Republicans. Again, his base was in the Wild counties, this amazing blood red base, which is simply unlike any base, suburban voting patterns that you see in other northern cities. That's what's so striking about Milwaukee, and I think that's what a lot of people don't realize, that you have most other northern cities, their suburbs have gotten more diverse, gotten more politically purple. In Milwaukee, it's the opposite. The suburbs have gotten redder and redder in the Wild counties. It's just really quite remarkable.
That part isn't news exactly in Wisconsin, that Milwaukee County is a blue county. The three neighboring counties are red counties, and we really watch those closely on election day. But looking at it from the outside, how unique is that? You mentioned among northern cities, are we really an anomaly throughout the country?
Yes, you're a tremendous anomaly. Looking at it in a comparative way, it's striking, and it's really kind of a mystery to a lot of political scientists and political demographers. The Journal Sentinel series did everyone the service of showing maps of other northern cities, Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis, Cleveland, and showing just how different the voting patterns are there. Whereas in Milwaukee, you have this very, very stark deep blue, deep red split between the city and the Wow counties. In these other cities, you have a much more, even Detroit, you have a much more kind of modeled fade swing areas sort of out spreading out from the cities. There's just much more diversity and heterogeneity of political sentiment in those cities. And that has partly to do with the fact that the suburbs and those other cities have simply gotten more diverse. In the Wow counties, you have these counties that are still less than 2% African American. I mean, that's just nothing. Even in Detroit, the suburbs there, Macomb and Oakland County are getting more diverse. Chicago, they're getting more diverse. It's really quite an anomaly. Some political scientists told me you have to look all the way to the southern cities of Atlanta and Birmingham to find suburbs that are as deep, deep red as what you have in Milwaukee.
So how does that affect, as you see it, Governor Walker's campaign strategy as a statewide politician before we get to the national level?
Right. Well, what I posit in the piece is that it's that he's come up in this realm where he's been able to rely on this incredibly strong base, and that just has put him in a kind of bubble or a kind of cocoon, which where it's his policies and just his whole sort of outlook has been much more about that base and fulfilling its demands and desires than about positioning himself to appeal more to swing voters, like you're seeing with some other. If you look at how the other Midwestern governors who came in at the same time as him in 2010, they really have taken a different approach. Governor Snyder in Michigan and Governor Kasich in Ohio, and because they're more attuned to what they see as the demands of the sort of swing voter in their state, where, again, Governor Walker has said himself that there's just not a whole lot of persuasion for him going on anymore. The other element of that bubble, which I talk a lot about in the piece, is talk radio. And this is another thing that's just really quite anomalous in Metro Milwaukee. It is very unusual for a mid-sized city to have so many very popular, very influential, very long-time local conservative talk radio hosts. You have, of course, the national talk radio guys everywhere, you know, Rush and those guys. But to have local guys who've been around for 20-plus years, like Charlie Sykes and Mark Belling, who are weighing in on local issues and are very informed on local issues and influencing matters at the local level, you know, pressuring state legislators on various amendments and various votes, weighing in primaries the way they did with Scott Walker and Mark Newman. This is really unusual, and it's, again, just part of this landscape that I think has really helped shape Governor Walker, who is so good at working those radio personalities. And my piece gets into just how early on he started making inroads with them and building relationships with them.
But we see all over the country increasing polarization, including a new Pew study that shows a more polarized landscape, less cooperation in politics, less reaching across the aisle, less effort to persuade the other side, more effort to rally the base. Doesn't Governor Walker, as you portray this story, fit really well into that national landscape?
He does. You know, it's interesting. I think in some ways, Wisconsin, Metro Milwaukee is in some ways ahead of the curve, but also behind the curve. It's ahead of the curve because it's gotten so polarized. And yes, the rest of the country is also getting more polarized, both in our, just in the politics in Washington, but also in just the way we live. We tend much more to live around people like us politically. So in that sense, Wisconsin, Metro Milwaukee are ahead of the curve. But as I explained in the piece, they're ahead of the curve in part because they're behind the curve. What the argument I make about why Metro Milwaukee is so segregated and polarized is actually that it's in a kind of time warp, that because the Great Migration came late to Milwaukee, which it did, it's pretty striking that in 1970, Milwaukee had the smallest black population percentage-wise of any of the largest 15 cities in the country. The migration just of African Americans from the South just didn't arrive in the first couple waves the way it did in Chicago and Detroit and other cities. So the African Americans came to Milwaukee in great numbers later. It was more 60s, 70s, and even 80s that you saw the movement to Milwaukee. And because of that delayed arrival, everything else was delayed. The suburban flight that you saw everywhere around the country happened later in Milwaukee. And then at the same time, of course, because the arrival was late, there was less time for sort of a African American middle class leadership elite to develop in Milwaukee before the whole jobs bottom just fell out of the manufacturing base. So you had this. You have this situation where it's almost like Milwaukee, Metro Milwaukee's caught in like in sort of like the, where other cities were in the 1980s, where you had this just real. The movement to the suburbs has been relatively recent. There's still this real tension between the cities and the suburbs. The suburbs haven't gotten diverse yet. Folks in the suburbs look at the city as this pretty sort of scary, dysfunctional place. There's a lot more talk about urban crime than you see elsewhere. And it's really is kind of a time warp. So in some ways, I think Metro Milwaukee might actually over time become less polarized as you see more minorities moving out to the suburbs. You might see the suburbs start to get a little more purple. But right now, it is in this kind of time warp, which again puts it kind of almost ahead of the other country in its polarization.
We're talking to Alec MacGillis about his cover story for the New Republic. It's called The Unelectable Whiteness of Scott Walker. And we want to hear from you. What is your reaction to this story if you've checked it out already or if you're just now hearing about it? Do you think Governor Scott Walker will run for president in 2016? Do you think his experience in Wisconsin will help him or hurt him if he does so? Call in and let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We're continuing our conversation with Alec MacGillis of the New Republic about his cover story, The Unelectable Whiteness of Scott Walker. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this story if you've read it? What do you make of political divisions in and around Milwaukee and how they affect statewide politics? Do you think the governor will run for president in 2016? Will his experience in Wisconsin help him or hurt him? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. But, Alec, a lot of the reaction from the governor's supporters looking at the headline of this piece, the case made throughout, is, hey, you are trying to call Governor Walker a racist, or at least taint him with the racist label, him and his supporters, especially in the counties, the metropolitan counties around Milwaukee. Is that what you're doing?
No, most certainly not. I think that the piece makes clear that nowhere in the piece is there any accusation of Governor Walker himself being racist or having done anything explicitly racist. What the piece tries to argue is that he comes out of a world that a political world and a realm that does have a fair amount of toxic stuff floating around in it. Some of the things that, you know, I describe Mark Belling and Charlie Sykes talking about and dwelling on a lot just has a definitely racially charged component when they're talking about Milwaukee issues, Milwaukee dysfunction. You've also seen some of these things coming out of Governor Walker's office, a lot of these emails and social media postings that are pretty ugly. Again, this is not Governor Walker himself, but there's just a lot of unpleasantness floating around and a certain view of things as regards Milwaukee and the African Americans living in Milwaukee. And I do believe that environment cannot help but sort of have an effect on people who come out of it.
But couldn't you say that it's not the racial divisions that are driving the support for Governor Walker, but you've got a lot of people in an economically similar area. Maybe they support his Republican policies on taxes, government spending, public employees, that sort of thing.
Oh, no doubt. He has an appeal, and he's been very good making the case for his agenda with his base. The argument of the piece is that his success, though, has relied so much on this base in the WOW counties that is unlike really almost anything else in the country. I mean, this is an incredibly monolithic base. To have a region like this where you have 80% turnout, 80% voting for him in some communities in both 2010 and then the recall. It's just really quite extraordinary, and we won't know until he runs, if he runs in 2016, how he would fare with a more diverse, both ideologically and sort of ethnically diverse kind of electorate. But it is just a very unusual environment to have come up in, and that's what the piece is trying to convey, this universe that has produced him.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Madison. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'd like to make a comment on specifically how the Scott Walker campaign specifically targeted conservative white males statewide in relation to the gun issue. Now, there was signage all over the state that said, Tom Barrett's going to take away your hunting rifles. And I saw these signs. I've traveled the state a lot, and there was huge signage everywhere across the state. Now, Tom Barrett, being from Milwaukee, has a huge gun violence issue, and obviously they need to do something about it within the city limits. And so they used that against him, trying to say that he would take away the rights of gun owners statewide, whereas anybody running for governorship in Wisconsin would know better than to even mess with the firearms rights of hunters. And once again, the Scott Walker campaign completely manipulated that and tried to make it seem as if they were going to take away guns from the entire statewide, when the real issue was how to control guns in the urban Milwaukee area. But this is a prime example of kind of what you're talking about, being too white. That was primarily designed to elicit a response from conservative white rural folks who don't understand the insane crime rate and gun deaths that are happening in the Milwaukee area.
Gotcha, Mike. Thanks for the call. Alec, what do you think of that as a campaign tactic that that Mike's talking about, and how could that translate to a national election?
Well, it's a good example to raise, and that's, of course, it's a general argument that Republicans elsewhere have made against Democratic candidates, of course, with some success in certain places. What I would just note as an aside to that is that it's one thing that's striking about Wisconsin politics is that you actually – rural voters are not as monolithically Republican in Wisconsin as elsewhere, and it's another unusual thing about Wisconsin that you have – in Wisconsin, the reddest place is really the wow counties, the suburbs of the big city. In most states, the reddest place are the rural areas, the sparsely settled outlying areas. Wisconsin, it's not the case. You look at the map, pick your year, and there are pockets of blue around rural small town Wisconsin. You've got this in Wisconsin. It's these suburbs. There's just really nothing like them in the country.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We'll go to Nick with us now in Greenfield. Nick, hi.
Yeah, hi, and thanks for taking my call, and hello, Mr. McGinnis. What I have to say is that Scott Walker and his Republican legislature passed laws reducing the days and times for voting to cut back the number of citizens that are able to vote in Milwaukee County. He wants to stack the deck in favor of those surrounding red counties. And as far as the racial component, Scott Walker may not be overtly racist, but what he did in his kind of backdoor way was severely curtail public transit in the city, which hurt the inner city citizens. So that's what I've got to say. And Mr. McGinnis, what's the name of your paper?
It's the New Republic. Alec, what do you have to say about what Nick brought up there on voter ID, voting law restrictions?
It's very important, and I mentioned this pretty centrally in my piece. I mean, I think this issue is just basically the clearest example of an actual policy that has been directed from Governor Walker and the Republican legislature to literally suppress Milwaukee and its residents. I mean, there's just you have this environment where turnout is everything. Turnout has become everything in Southeast Wisconsin. It's all about who gets their base out in the elections. And to the extent that you can, even just at the margins, lower the amount of turnout in Milwaukee, voters who rely on early voting to vote in the days before the election because they can't get to the polls in the election because lines are long on election day, because you just have a lot more people voting in a densely settled city, are now going to have a tougher time getting to the polls. And there's no other way to look at that decision to cut back on those hours. The voter ID bill, of course, has been struck down by the judge, but the early voting cutbacks stand, and that's going to have an impact. And the motivation there, it's not hard to see what it is.
You've painted Scott Walker's background in Wisconsin as ultimately a liability. You say he over-relies on a very devoted base in a unique series of mainly three counties surrounding Milwaukee County. But you also point towards some strengths, a very message-disciplined politician, somebody who does a good job working with conservative media to reach out to the base, somebody who brings the base to the polls. Isn't that something that could serve him well in a Republican primary for president and in a general election?
He has definite strengths. He, for one thing, he checks all the boxes for the Republican coalition. He's an evangelical Christian, which makes him more than acceptable to religious Republican voters. He is very strong on taxes and welfare and unions. Just really satisfies that sort of that part of the coalition, and he's presumably pretty strong on national security stuff. So and then at the same time the other strength is that he's able to bridge that gap between the Tea Party and the Republican establishment. He's very popular with Tea Party Republicans because of the way he took on the unions, but at the same time he doesn't come across as somehow a fringe person. He's also acceptable to many establishment Republicans. So I would argue that he would actually be probably pretty good in the primaries. In the general election, that's where things would get tougher. The one thing I would say to his appeal, though, even in the primaries, he's not the most electrifying speaker, and I think that could be his biggest hindrance in the primaries, even with sort of base voters around the country. He's pretty sort of flat on the stump, not all that charismatic, although I think some people say he's gotten better in that regard. I think that could be his main hindrance in the primaries.
Some of his supporters in the state have said, hey, this piece you wrote, Alec, it's a political hit piece trying to derail a potentially strong Republican, well, candidate for governor, first of all, potentially candidate for president. How do you respond?
Well, I would respond that I'll speak a little bit to the sort of derivation of this piece. We just thought it was time to do a good profile of Governor Walker. There's not been, it's funny, there's been a lot of stuff written about Act 10 and the protests and the recall, but in the national press there haven't been that many in-depth profiles of Governor Walker. So we thought it was a good time to sort of do that and introduce him to people who don't know that much about him. But I took it as an excuse really to write about something that I've been intrigued about for a while, which is this polarization and segregation in Metro Milwaukee. I've known a little bit about it for a while, and I've always been fascinated by it and also kind of depressed by it. I mean, it's not a nice thing, but I just wanted to learn more about it. And the more I got looked into it with the help of that incredible series in the Journal Sentinel, and which had those just amazing maps and data on just how stark the divides had gotten, I just thought, this is a way to introduce people to this part of the country and these really quite unusual dynamics that are going on here.
Alec, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Alec MacGillis, senior editor at The New Republic and author of the piece, The Unelectable Whiteness of Scott Walker. It's this issue's cover story. You can find a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page and keep up the conversation over there. Java, mud, jet fuel, black gold, coffee. It's the fourth most consumed beverage in the world. For a lot of us, coffee is the only thing that keeps us going at work in the morning. A lot of us get our coffee beans from the store, but if you really want the freshest coffee around at a price that might surprise us, you can roast your own. For today's edition of Teach Me What You Know, we're joined by Gary and John Berman. They're with Berman Coffee Traders in Middleton. They're here to teach us how to roast our own coffee at home. Gary, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having us out.
And John, thanks for coming up.
Oh, thank you.
All right, Gary, how did you guys get started roasting your own beans?
Well, I've had a lot of jobs, and early on I was a stockbroker and option trader, and I was watching the coffee market. And then later in life I became an internet guy and was teaching internet technology to telecommunications companies. And in 2001, the bubble broke, those guys all got in trouble, and their training budget went away, and I was out of a job. So I sort of took a hobby of mine, which was coffee, and started to explore why coffee could be trading on an exchange at 50 cents a pound, and Starbucks is selling it at 12 bucks a pound, looking for an opportunity to. And I couldn't get any of the business plans to work. Coffee shops were tough. There was a lot of roasters in town. So I bought myself a little home roaster and started playing with it. And I went, wow, this is fun, and this is kind of cool.
And John, how did this turn into a family gig?
Well, fortunately, Gary had some luck and needed some help down the road. I was in college at the time and had a little unfortunate trip back, and so I needed a place to live, and he needed some labor. And that started my passion.
Well, you've got the labor here. Now, tell us about the gear, Gary. What do we need to get rolling on roasting?
Okay, well, the reason to home roast is, you know, it's sort of, we use the bread or a popcorn analogy. If you, you know, you can go to Woodman's or a grocery store, you can buy a bag of popcorn, you can buy a loaf of bread, but it's not the same as going to the movie theater and getting freshly popped popcorn, or going to a bread store and getting something roasted that day. Same things with coffee. So, that, you know, you want to drink fresh coffee if you can. You've probably only drank stale coffee up till now. So coffee in the first couple of days, you just smelled it. You can taste it.
Yeah, you've got some samples here. We'll try in a bit. Yeah.
So to roast your own, first, the advantages are, you know, it's fresh. Secondly, we go out and we track down some of the coolest coffees in the world. And so you're getting a selection of coffees that you just can't tap for most roasters. And then green coffee is very cost effective. It's gone up sharply from the 50 cents it was when I first started the business. But still, the average green coffee is $5, $6 a pound for estate grown coffees that are top from that country.
So where would I buy green coffee? I have no idea.
Online.
Or
in Middleton. But most of it's a small niche, so most of those who are involved in home coffee roasting are online.
And John, does this get like wine? We've got a lot of options, each with their own characters, depending on where they're from.
Oh, yeah, it's very cool. You can get tastes and flavors in coffee that most people don't know about. There's about 3 to 4 major processing methods, origins, different strains. There's all sorts of factors that will change the way your cup of coffee tastes.
So you get to be a mad scientist.
Yeah, to some degree. When everybody get who home roast gets to, and it only takes 10 minutes to roast, so it's not hard. You figure out what you're... Each color, each shade of brown tastes different, so you sort of like barbecue, and you figure out what your favorite, you know, way of your color is, and then you roast your coffee to that color, and you explore the world of different coffees.
Well, like you said, you brought a sample. You've got the unroasted here. You've got roasted here. I don't know if these are the same.
Exactly, and
same
that's
species.
What you're drinking.
And most importantly, I haven't tasted it. I'm going to taste it. I've reached for it by instinct like 5 times already. Tell us, while I'm drinking, tell us about the green, the roasted, and then what I'm drinking here.
Sure. So, what we do each year is collect samples from all the different importers and what comes into this country, and we sort through and we try and find the best coffees we can. But the best kind of relationships we have is when we find a project that we really like, and then we just support it year in and year out. We like what they're doing. We know they're committed to good cause. So this is one of the few American projects. So this is from Maui. There's the only U.S. coffees are grown in Hawaii and Puerto Rico. So this is a cool project. They've been doing it now for about 4 or 5 years. They produce better coffee each year. So it comes green. You see it what it's like. It's a hard, dried product that's an annual crop. And then you put it in your method of roasting, which could be a popcorn popper or what we use and endorse our dedicated roasters. It takes maybe 6-7 minutes of roast time to get
that's
to.
All.
And then you're picking your favorite, you know, each color is going to taste different. So when you know what you like, when you've got your favorite roast, that's where you take it.
Khan Pali Red, am I reading that right?
Correct.
Khan Pali Red. So this has a lot. This is a complex flavor I'm drinking. This is when people are talking fancy wines or beers or you know, my favorite bourbons. There's a series of flavors going around. How do you talk about that?
Well, the way we evaluate coffees is by cupping. It's called, the process is cupping. And what we have in front of us when we cup is a flavor wheel of all different adjectives on the term. And you sit down, you evaluate a coffee, and you talk about what you taste in it. And you look for defects take away from the score, but positive flavors add to the score. So you talk about some of the lower flavors, whether it's chocolatey or caramely or whatever. You talk about whether it's got fruity overtones or sweet or, you know, and you know, what is in there. That and you can taste the roast a little bit in this coffee. It's got a little bit of the roast taste. You're tasting it's sweet and you're tasting. It's fairly complex.
Yeah.
This is actually a blend. So they process coffee 2 different ways on that estate. And this is a blend of both of their types of, because it made it more complex.
John, is part of your job being the taster here?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And my biggest passion in the business.
That's got to be part of the best part. Now, I know there's sometimes a risk of over-roasting, and my wife, who knows more about coffee than I do, tells me, yeah, that place over-roasts, or I smell this delicious smell driving around, and she's like, oh, they over-roasted that batch. Yeah. How do we know when we've roasted it enough?
Well, it's by color. I mean, the easiest way to judge coffee is by color. Mm. But in the roasting process, coffee goes through, it pops twice. So the first, for coffee to be roasted, it has to get hot enough where it actually pops like popcorn. And that's called the first crack. And it'll expand, it'll be double the size. So you can see those beans that are roasted are actually double the size of the...
Honestly, I wouldn't have said this was coffee if I didn't know when you showed it to me. It's tiny, it's a different color.
Right. So for the first thing you do is you go through that first crack. And then depending, a dark roast will happen to the point where you get to the second crack. The first crack is because the bean is so fibrous, it's got moisture content in it. It gets hot, boom, it expands the bean and you go through the first crack. The second crack is now it's converted all these organic compounds into flavor oils. And now the flavor oils, you're getting hotter and hotter and are starting to get volatile and vaporize. And they'll blow a piece off the bean. And that's called the second crack. So when you're roasting, when I hear the second crack, I'm done. I go, wow, that's dark enough for me. And if you go too much darker than that, you're starting to hit health. There's probably some, it's probably healthier, it's like anything else, not to burn it too much. Uh-huh. But you can judge by color. So as long as it's still brown, if you roasted it yourself, you just heard the beginning of the second crack, you're probably... You're fine.
Only 7-8 minutes, you said. What's the time difference between a light roast and a dark roast then?
Well, that's John? All said. Roasting, you set your roasting curve, which is all time versus temperature. Yeah. So depending on just like cooking anything, you cook it at a higher temperature, it's going to cook quicker. Now, some of the smaller, what they call fluid bed, which is air roasters, those will roast more in 7-8 minutes. Some of the drum roasters, especially the big commercial ones, start getting up 12, 13, 14. But you're in charge of the recipe. So certain attributes come out with longer roasts. Some people shoot for a 20-minute roast. Tends to mute up all the acidity and really bring forth some nice dark tones. And some people on the shorter edge really bring forth the citrus characteristic, which would be floral, soft fruit. And so when you're in charge, you get to choose. You know, it's mm-hmm. all personal preference. Everybody likes something different. You know, we're catered people that love burnt coffee, love light roast coffee. And the cool thing about home roasting, you get to pick, figure out how to do it, and adopt it to your own flavor.
All right, we've just roasted a big batch. What's the best way to store it?
Well, green coffee, the trick is keep it green until you're going to drink it.
Wow.
Then roasted coffee probably only stays really fresh for about a week. So, you know, but the roasters don't roast that much. So, you know, you're going to have you're going to drink what you roasted probably within the week and be out.
And that's the advantage. We're drinking freshly roasted coffee, and that's different than stuff that's been traveling and sitting around for a while post-roasting.
Right.
Absolutely. 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 The big trick, keep it out of the fridge, keep it out of the freezer. It's actually a degassing process that sets it up and keeps it fresh. Anything you do to stunt that process will actually stunt the flavor of the coffee.
So. You guys have me almost tempted to try this. This coffee you gave me is really good. Maybe I'll have to try this at home sometime. John, thanks a lot for coming up.
Oh, thank you.
And Gary, thank you too for sharing coffee with us.
We appreciate the opportunity.
That was Gary and John Berman. They're the owners of Berman Coffee Traders in Middleton.